Good morning, Arizona. Thank you for joining us on the phone. Before I introduce our guest today, I want to introduce Steve from Search and Rescue, Pima County Search and Rescue. Steve, how you doing?
I'm fine, Sherry. Good morning. How are you?
I'm okay. Tell us what happened. This is kind of sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. A few months ago, a couple of volunteers and I were guests on your radio program from the Southern Arizona Rescue Association. And we're talking about what their role is in the community and how they, how Pima County Search and Rescue really couldn't effectively do our job without them. And this week, we suffered a loss of a longtime member that these boots are pretty big boots to fill. So I just wanted to share with your audience that last week, the rescue community of Southern Arizona lost a longtime member, Scotty Clemens. And Scotty had been a member of the Southern Arizona Rescue Association for 55 years.
Wow.
I'd like to stop right there and just let that sink in, that 55 years as a volunteer, giving up so much of his life to the organization and the community. Scotty started at the age of 17, and he remained active his entire life. I mean, again, talk about longevity here. That's just amazing. Scotty was a selfless volunteer. He'd do whatever needed to be done, and he showed that over and over. We've got a new class of people that are coming up through SAR right now. They're going through their training, and the really unfortunate thing is they're not going to benefit from the knowledge and experience. And they're not going to be able to be underneath Scotty's wing and learn from him like so many of us have. But, you know, this is what happens. But I just want to share with you over the years, our records indicate from 1978 that Scotty was himself on 1,650 missions.
Wow.
He contributed 5,111 hours of his time to the community of Southern Arizona. 21 years combined on the board of directors with Sarah. 20 years DPS helicopter certified, rappel and short haul, which meant that Scotty was one of the guys that if he needed to be inserted with a helicopter, he could be inserted with the helicopter. And he just finished his current certification prior to his death. He was a 55-year member of Sarah, like I said, Pima Search and Rescue. He was on our medical team, on our training team. To his wife, Sue, and his family, he was a husband, father, and a grandfather. To many others through our organization and the people that met him, he was a mentor and a friend that can't even imagine what he meant to so many people.
That's a remarkable legacy, though. Think about that. Wow.
Absolutely. And here's the thing that's so amazing, and it really is a tribute to Scotty, is that to many people that never even knew his name, that he had contact with through various searches and rescues, whether it was in the middle of the night, a snowstorm or rain or whatever. So many people he touched, Scotty Clemens is a real life hero. He's a guy that they might not have ever known his name, but they would have never gotten out of their situation without his assistance. He's a guy that's going to be greatly missed and fondly remembered, and I just can't say enough good about him, and I just really want the community to understand what our volunteers are, what a value they are, and just what they bring to the table.
Absolutely. I remember the show you're talking about, and it's just remarkable what these people do. They're so selfless and so giving of their time. Obviously, you just talked about that. Tell us, if you will, for us, tell us his family that he's in our thoughts, he's in our prayers, and we send all our positive energy to them. I know this is going to be a rough time for them.
Well, I believe the family is listening at this time, so you just told them yourself, and if we can just as a community remember, we can't function without these people that just go out there and give of their time, and they do it oftentimes just in the shadows, and we don't take the time to recognize them. But like I said, big, big boots to fill for the loss with Scotty Clements, and he'll greatly be missed.
I second that. I appreciate you calling in and letting us know what happened, and you know, kudos to all our volunteers. I mean, these people are amazing. And so are you, Steve.
Well, thanks for giving me an opportunity to just get this out there, because they're just a special group. We're really fortunate. So, Sherry, thank you for what you do for law enforcement community and give me this opportunity.
Okay, you have a safe day, all right? Happy Halloween to you.
I'm planning on. Thank you. Same to you, my friend.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, in the studio today, we have John Levitt. Everybody knows who he is. Tell our listeners who you are and what you do.
I'm John Levitt. I'm a captain with the Tucson Police Department, but I've been assigned for the last 4 years to be the commander of the Counter-Narcotics Alliance, which is a state, local, federal task force under the what they call HIDA, a federal umbrella, and we do the undercover drug law enforcement from soup to nuts across southern Arizona.
You do it all.
Yeah, it's a great job. It's a great job because it's the first time in my 38 years in law enforcement where everybody pulls the same direction. There's nobody that's there that doesn't want to be there, and they're happy to come to work every day. And that's an experience I'd never had before, where everyone literally was trying to accomplish the same goals.
So tell me, what are the tools you use for your job? What do you do?
So we have a variety of different squads that look at different parts of the drug trafficking and drug sales problem. But we also do education and outreach and harm reduction and those kinds of activities. And we've been, leaders in the state, at least, when it comes to investigating overdose deaths, to try to find out what we can do to reduce the overdose deaths that we have and to hold people accountable for selling drugs that ultimately kill people. And so we do that. I've got detectives. I've got officers. I've got dogs. Got a couple of new dogs I know that you asked about earlier.
I saw them. They're gorgeous.
Yeah, we use Labradors, and we have a couple of new Labradors that just came on board here a couple of weeks ago in the training phase, and they're really instrumental in helping us develop probable cause to do searches of parcels and vehicles and things like that. So we may have information that says, you know, this... Someone may call 88 crime, as they do a lot. 88 crime is something that really provides us a lot of information. And they say, my neighbors are selling drugs. They put all their drugs in a pickup every night, and then they leave with it in the morning. And if that were true, then we would go out and do a surveillance and see if the vehicle's leaving. And if it leaves, we'd wait till it committed a traffic violation. And most people do on an average trip. Stop it for the traffic violation. And while we're talking to them about the traffic violation, we'd run the dog. The dog would hopefully, I mean, if there's drugs there, would alert. And then we would be able to combine that with the other things that we know to develop probable cause to eventually search the vehicle and interdict the drugs. So that's pretty common.
So you're talking about the dogs. I know Jeff trained the dogs, but you said the dogs are still in training. Mm-hmm. So he trains them initially, and then they get trained with their handler. Do they go with just one handler, or this is the dog and anybody can use the dog?
So it's a little more complicated than that. When we buy the dogs, they come with some amount, small amount of training, and it's generally obedience, and they'll do scent training to prove that they're good at doing scent detection. We'll select a dog, and then Jeff and the TPD dog unit help us get these dogs up to a certification level where we can prove that they're actually detecting the right scents and things like that, right? But the handler spends probably 25% of their time throughout the dog's service life training them. So it's a very, very tedious, if you don't like training, it's a tedious job. But these guys, they spend a very large percentage of their time making sure their dogs are at top performance when we need them to be.
So do the dogs go home with their handler?
Yes, they do. They live at
home. So they have one handler?
Yes. And okay. We have moved dogs from handler to handler. You can do that. Dogs typically have about a five-year span where they're serviceable as a detector dog, maybe six or seven. But And at the end of that, if we can, we try to retire the dog with the handler. And they may live 10 or 12 or 14 years. Labs don't live forever.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. But they have good life. They're very happy dogs. They're actively engaged in problem solving every day. They're, you know, they have full lives as dogs, and they're very well treated and become very valuable after we supply all the training. So.
And I'm talking to Steve, by the way, he talks about the dogs that they use, mm-hmm. and it's a constant, you have to train
yes.
every week. It's not
right.
something, okay, they're done.
That's right.
So it's a huge job. Let's talk about the initiative.
So there's an initiative to legalize recreational marijuana on the ballot on Tuesday. And, you know, from the last initiative and others, you know that I've been opposed to legalizing recreational marijuana, and personally and professionally. And I listened really carefully this time to what people are saying, and I think the overwhelming thing people are saying is, in the interest of criminal justice reform, they want to get everyone out of prison who's there for a marijuana charge. And I think the thing that really, really strikes me is that's just not true. It's a false narrative that's been sold to the American people, and particularly the people in Arizona, that everyone's in jail for a marijuana charge. And when I say that, I have now spent a solid year, every time I've heard that, making the offer. If you can find me someone who's in prison in the state of Arizona for simple possession of marijuana only, I'll do what I can to get them out. Because 38 years in law enforcement, I can tell you, maybe 38 years ago, people went to prison for possession of marijuana. But in the last decade, let's just look at hard narcotics first. It takes, if you get caught with methamphetamine three times under a normal circumstance, it takes three times for you to be what we call Prop 200 ineligible. Prop 200 mandates drug court, and drug court mandates treatment. Well, you know that, and Sherry, you know this about us at CNA, we're 100% behind treatment. We don't want to be putting users in jail.
Yes.
Although that's always the narrative you hear. Well, we shouldn't be putting users in jail. Well, we agree. And listen and pay attention, because we don't want to do that either. But in the case of marijuana, we've been writing tickets for marijuana my entire career. 38 years we've been writing tickets for it. You don't even necessarily get to go to jail, let alone prison. Jail and prison are two different things.
Right.
And so what I did find out was, when I would get these cases, and generally it's a reformed public defender or something that tells me, and he gives me, it's James Smith, and he's in Maricopa County Jail or prison in Florence, and he has been, and he's, so I'll pull the case up and I'll look at it, and I've done this dozens and dozens of times. When I say pull it up, I use public records. I make sure I don't do anything you couldn't do, because that's the problem, is the public's perception. And I pull up these cases out of the Maricopa County Superior Court records, and I look. Yeah, it's true. James Smith is in prison for possession of marijuana. He's 69 years old, and he just took a plea to 1 year in prison for that. Except he took a plea to get rid of the other charges that he was facing. And so people will take a plea to possession of marijuana so they can avoid the prison sentence associated with other issues that they're facing. And in the case, most recent case I looked at, the guy had armed robbery charges. He had all these other charges. So, again, I make the offer. I know it's Tuesday soon, but let me know who's in prison in the state of Arizona for a simple marijuana charge. Now, I don't mean, you know, and even on talk shows you'll hear, it was just simply possession of marijuana.
Yeah.
Well, he had 26 tons, you know. I mean, okay. So, non-sale amounts, possession of marijuana, nobody's in prison. And if they are, let me know, and I'll do my best to get them out. And so, anyway, that's the thing that really irked me in this go-around on this particular initiative, because that's the way it's being sold, is it's criminal justice reform, and it's just not. The other thing about it is, and it's really, really true now more than ever before, this is not Cheech and Chong's marijuana that we're talking about anymore.
Yeah.
You know, my generation, when I went to high school, graduated actually in 1978, highest high school use for students in the history of our country of marijuana. It's significantly less now, even though it's legal in many states. So we have made progress in people's using of recreational drugs, and particularly in marijuana. But this idea that it's harmless and all of that. Okay, so, and here's the other thing that gets me, because I'm a reasonably progressive political person, just put it that way. I believe in climate change. I believe in climate change science. I believe that the pandemic is a pandemic, and I believe in the health officials and their science. I also believe in the recent studies that have come out of places like Harvard and Stanford about the danger of marijuana. And my friends who share my other progressive views want to believe the science about climate change and about the virus, but they refuse to believe the science from these respected institutions and journals about marijuana. And when they say, hey, but I've got these 15 studies, they always send me links, like 20 links at once. And they're all from High Times Magazine and, you know, Marijuana Joint Roller Magazine. And they're from dubious sources and they're debunked studies. And so all I can say is pay attention to the new science. This is not Cheech and Chong's marijuana. It's a dangerous drug. Can it be used responsibly? I'm sure it can be. Probably most people do. But then the final question is, we know our hospitals have been tested recently. Do we have the healthcare capability of handling yet another drug of abuse or misuse, if you want to talk?
Misuse, yeah.
So, yeah, do we really? I mean, do we want to fill the beds with people who have problems from drugs of misuse? And do we have the capacity to do that? Do we have extra money in the system that we're ready to spend on it? So, again, this is not the comparison between alcohol and marijuana. Well, it's no worse than alcohol. Okay, well, how's that work for us?
Yeah. I mean,
right? So, and it's certainly no worse than tobacco. Tobacco is the biggest killer of all of them, right? It's legal.
Smoke a smoke.
But what we're asking people to do is a change in public policy. And I would hope in the third millennium, our goal as Americans would be to improve public health with changes in policy as opposed to hurt public health. And there's no question that as you say that it's okay and you make it legal, more people will use it. And when more people use it, more people will misuse it. And when more people misuse it, you're going to cause a declination in general public health. So, again, it's not a moral question, and it's not an equivalency. It's not, is it worse or better than alcohol? And, you could make any argument you make for legalization of marijuana recreationally, I can make for oxycodone. And we know what oxycodone does, right?
Yeah.
So I can make the same argument, though. Oh, you can use it responsibly. There's no question about that. People do every day. Most people do. So,
well, marijuana stays in your system a lot longer than.
Yeah. So I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. No, actually, I've seen studies and read them, and I know some of the early studies done at Stanford are disregarded by a lot of people, but they're good. And they basically show that you can become high a couple of days later after you use marijuana. And so that's, the driving questions are serious. Yeah. And this idea that, I know a guy who I smoke marijuana and I don't go out and drive afterwards. Oh, come on. I mean, in Colorado, where they've followed this pretty closely, there's a huge increase in people driving while impaired, with the use of marijuana. And of course, the way this initiative deals with that is they try to make it so that we can't measure those things or make it affect our ability to do the DUI drug laws. So, look at how fair is it that they're going to allow this new recreational drug that won't hurt anyone to only be sold by the people who've been licensed now? I mean, and with a few exceptions. So, I mean, it's the whole thing is, I feel like we're being punked.
Yeah,
I'm looking for the cameras and, I mean, I would guess the polls are probably correct and that there's probably going to be broad support, but it's based on this idea that it's criminal justice reform.
It's misinformation.
Well, there's no, the low hanging fruit that everyone think is out there when it comes to drugs and criminal justice, just, it's not there. I mean, I know that we keep repeating that same lie, but it's just not there. It's even true with, what you would call hard drugs. Every Wednesday, I'm part of a group, and I'm hopefully there's a few of them listening to it here, that we do this program where we go through and we try to find people in jail and remove them. And we do find out of, as many as 2,000 people in jail on a given day, we do find 4 or 5 cases a week that we look at and we go, how do they end up getting there? And we pull them out. And so, but see, here's the difference. They get incredible services offered to them because we find them and we have all the service providers at the table. And this isn't about just releasing them. One of the tragedies, I think, of COVID has been judges have decided that they're going to dismiss personal possession of hard narcotics cases out of hand in court at initial appearances. That's not when they get a lawyer. That's at initial appearances. And that sounds great if you're for criminal justice reform, right? Those people don't get any services at all. And right now I'm going through everyone that was done since March, and I'm going to look for all those that have overdosed afterwards that we might have been able to get to, because we do the overdose investigation. So we're taking a look at the hundreds of those that have died, and we're going to see how many were dismissed, and we're going to take a look at those cases. Because it's, we only have a few chances for intervention. Tucson Police Department is offering people treatment as opposed to arrest for possession cases.
Okay, I want to address that, because I've heard from law enforcement that if they don't have a court order, they can't keep them in treatment. They can only keep them for like 3 days.
So you're right. So they can't even keep them at all. I mean, our program is voluntary deflection.
So imagine they have to want to be.
You imagine yourself as someone who's got a job and a family, and you have a paper. I use the wrong words because I'm old. You have a baggie of meth in your pocket, because I mean, I don't know anyone who actually uses it recreationally. It's all, in my experience, people do it to keep from getting sick from their addiction, the problem that they have. But you get caught with a warrant from driving. I don't know, an old photo red light warrant from back when we had photo red light. And a search incident to arrest, they find a small amount of this narcotic. Well, up until 2 years ago, we didn't have a choice. We just booked you. We had to book you for the crime of possession of a dangerous drug. That was what we had to do. And it's a felony. It's a class 4 felony. And when you got booked for that, that means you'd stay till arraignments, which would be now 12 hours apart, so 12 hours maximum. And then you'd be released, but then you'd have a whole series of appointments you had to meet and other judicial actions and all that. So it created huge disruption in your life. Well, what the Tucson Police Department did, and I think they're alone in Southern Arizona in doing this, is they said, all right, we have this baggie of methamphetamine here. We're going to give you an option. I mean, the police officer uses their discretion in offering this. It's not all the time. But we're going to give you an option. Would you like to go to treatment? We can introduce you to some people at treatment, or do you want to go to jail? And, well, you'd like to think everyone would say treatment, please, but they don't. Most people say, I'd like to go to jail.
Really?
Yeah, so we take quite a few people to treatment, and so now, that's not enough, right? Because I have to say that I know a little bit more now about substance use disorder than I did when I started this, effort, or when I was involved in the beginning of this effort. So now what we do at Counter Narcotics Alliance is we do all the issuing appointments. It's a path. So let's say you say, no, I don't want to do that. Take me to jail. So we take you to jail. Then you wake up the next day and you're no longer high, or you're no longer the influence. You've had time to sit and think about what you've done to your life, and we'll give you another offer. And when we give you the second offer, I think the last 20 times we did it, 19 people said no. So one said he wanted to do it. Now, that's important, because you got to start somewhere. But we get these people into treatment. Now, let's suppose they say no. Okay, well, then they go and they get charged officially. County attorney gets the opportunity under Prop 200 to offer people their programs that they have.
So that's three times.
They get plenty of, then they get three arrests to offer you a program. So there's all this treatment that we're trying to accomplish. And it's just the nature of what people go through with substance use disorder, where they don't, they just refuse help from everyone, including their families. And those of you all out there that have a family member that's got this issue, you know exactly what I mean. You know, ultimately, all those things have to happen, and so it's not what you keep hearing. It's not a case where everyone's going to jail because they had one time, use possession of any drug. And I'll go back to the whole idea about the only people that people want to see go to prison for drugs now are kingpins, right?
Right.
Well, you know, they've done some really high-profile releases where they've commuted sentences and they've pardoned people. They say, oh, it's a non-violent drug offense. And you go, well, what do you mean by that? Well, it was a nonviolent drug trafficking offense. I got to tell you, I don't know where those happen, because they don't happen in Tucson, Arizona. You know, there's violence associated with drug distribution everywhere. It's not like a group of pleasant people passing crack out on credit. The grandmother that was recently pardoned by the president, everyone is, really enthusiastic about that. She was a lieutenant in a drug trafficking organization, and maybe she personally didn't pull the trigger or hand the drugs to someone. She was a kingpin. So, I mean, our whole idea about what this stuff is very frustrating for the people that do the work. And you've met narcotics officers. You know that most of them are doing the work they do because they've lost someone to drug use.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons they all pull the same direction. And they're not particularly judgmental. It's not like they're out there, you know, twisting the heads off Barbie dolls. I mean, they're they are very, very professional in what they do. It's not at all like Serpico or TV or any of that stuff. And the myth of how this work is done and why people do it and all of that has overtaken the reality, and it makes it really hard to solve those problems.
It is a huge problem. Huge problem. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few.
This is Nathan Chabon, producer for Law Matters. I have a goal to reach, and I need your help. I want to put the DEA out of business. That's right, the Drug Enforcement Agency. If you have an addiction problem or know someone who does, please reach out to lawmatters1030.org and click the DEA tab for more information. Reaching out is the first step. We have the resources if you have the will. You can beat this demon and help me put the Drug Enforcement Agency out of business.
Hi, this is Sherry. If you think your current interest rate is high and refinancing is on your mind, give me a call at 520-310-9900. Maybe you're thinking about purchasing a new home while rates are low. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. Perhaps you just want to know how a reverse mortgage can improve your life. Give me a call at 520-310-9900. I can help you with all your mortgage needs, and I look forward to hearing from you. Thanks.
I'm Maya Thompson, producer for the Law Matters live show that airs Saturday mornings at 8, when our listeners ask questions of the people who have answers. On our next show, DEA Assistant Special Agent in Charge Polo Ruiz talks about working on both sides of the border. We can't do it without your support. Please go to lawmatters1030.org to contribute. If you missed us live, check out Law Matters on iTunes, Google Play, lawmatters1030.org, and of course, kvoi.com. Now get your questions ready and join our conversation at 790-2040. We thank you.
To report suspected human trafficking, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP or INFO to 233-733. To learn more about Homeland Security investigations and our efforts to combat human trafficking, please visit our website at www.ice.gov or check out the DHS Blue Campaign at www.dhs.gov/bluecampaign. For more information on the Southern Arizona Anti-Trafficking Unified Response Network, please visit us at www.saturn.org or find us on Facebook.
Thanks for staying with us. Our guest today, John Levitt from Counter Narcotics, TPD. If you have any questions, the number is 790-2040. And I want to talk about vaping a little bit. How does this affect the vaping community? Because I see more and more kids, people, vaping.
Well, I mean, we were concerned last year when you and I talked about how vaping had exploded. And there's no question when you look at the Monitoring the Future drug studies that are done at the University of Michigan. They're a tremendous resource when it comes to looking at long-term drug misuse. And they had registered some real changes and increases in vaping. Of course, vaping, nicotine turns into vaping, marijuana, and marijuana distillates. And that has become a problem because of the vast majority of vaping that's done with marijuana distillates is done with black market distillates. And I'm not trying to claim that the ones you buy at a dispensary are safe. But I will say there tends to be greater quality control in places that can be sued than there are from your street dealer. And so we know that the street dealers were mixing THC compounds with vitamin E oil at the time. This is a year ago. And that was causing, according to CDC and others, that was causing a severe reaction for some people when it comes to their cardiopulmonary system. So we also were really worried that we had found some cases where methamphetamine had been used in vape pens that had been adjustable for the heat. So the first vape pens weren't available to do that. Some newer ones were, and maybe some of them were hacked to do it. We found a few of those pens last year. They found a few in California, but they're not prevalent. So that is not the way people are using meth generally. Maybe it can be used that way, but it's not the way they are using meth. So that's a good sign. Certainly during the pandemic, with all the other respiratory ailments that people have, vaping is not a good idea. and culturally,
not on a good day.
Well, the problems that it brought about when it comes to people's lung function, and you know all the cases that happened in. That really was a warning, I think, for people. I don't know what's happening with the national vaping numbers. I know at schools it had taken over. Now nobody was in schools for a while, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, it's another self-inflicted wound that we're doing from a health perspective. And I don't really know if there's any reasonable studies that show whether or not it stops people from using nicotine by smoking or not in the end. I mean, it's a little while before we'll figure out how all that works.
How has COVID, have you seen any difference in what's going on because of COVID?
Yeah, so I think if you look at our spike in overdose fatalities in July, we responded to 40 overdoses in July. There were many more than that in Pima County. We only respond pretty much to the ones in the city. But when we looked at those 40, that was double, actually more than double of what we normally would do in a month. And for the first time, I think in April or May, the deaths from overdoses from single cause drugs, many of them are polydrug, they call for many different drugs, but, were from fentanyl. And in those cases, because we do actually pretty complete investigations on those now, fentanyl was most often found in the M30 pills that were counterfeit. Those people that are dying from that would likely have died probably, or many of them, from methamphetamine were it not for the COVID virus. And so why is that? So I know people like, we try to twist our minds around why that is. So cartels made a conscious decision back in January, February, March, and certainly by March, not to push methamphetamine across the border as they were. And that was because when you locked the border down and you restricted border traffic, there weren't that many people coming across the border. Still some people are, but not in the huge numbers that were before. So it's, you know, I don't like to use the term about people, but the term that they use when they analyze border crossings has to do with clutter. It has to do with the number of good people, essentially, that are out there that clutter up the environment for being able to detect the people that are engaged in smuggling. And so when you close down the border, smugglers stick out. And so they made the conscious decision not to import a lot. And I think, you know, later you're going to have the assistant special agent in charge from the DEA, Polo Ruiz, on your show on another day. He's the expert at this, and he's done a lot of research into it, and it's really, really knowledgeable. But essentially, when they stopped doing that, the price of methamphetamine went up 3 to 4 times in a month. And so, I mean, I was going over the stats in July 1st for the second quarter of the year, and I looked at them and went like, where'd all the meth go? And the answer is the meth has, you know, been restricted. It's not that they stop making it or, you know, it's just, it hasn't come across the border. And so people went to the next economically viable choice to treat their substance use disorder. And that was fentanyl pills, because fentanyl pills are still here. And, you know, oddly, another thing that it caused was California, of course, has a legal marijuana business, and it has the same laws everyone else does when it comes to other hard narcotics, but an enormous amount of drugs come from California through Arizona on I-40 and on I-10 and I-8. And so, the hard drug seizures, we started making fentanyl seizures and meth seizures from California coming through Arizona, during COVID. And we've always been doing the marijuana products, finding those coming through Arizona. But now it's hard drugs as well. California is an amazing state. Well, now it's amazingly dangerous to us when it comes to the import of narcotic drugs. So, I mean, COVID's affected us in those ways. If you've noticed, in the last couple of weeks, there's been just some ginormous, that's a term used in law enforcement, ginormous seizures of methamphetamine at the ports. They did, I think, 4,000 pounds the other day. Right. So those are unprecedented, you know, record seizures, and it's because they're starting to push those drugs back across the border again. And meth is becoming more available again. But so here we are. I mean, meth is a very, very difficult addiction to treat. And now, I'm not going to say fentanyl is easier, but there are medicine-assisted treatments that are pretty successful in dealing with any opiates. When I say pretty successful, I mean not as successful as we'd like. But methamphetamine is a difficult one, and it's always been sort of the drug of last resort. It's where people go after they've ruined every other aspect of their lives. But now it appears fentanyl's taking that role.
So people can become addicted to marijuana.
Yeah, although the people that are pushing this statute don't think so. I know people who have been using marijuana since I was in high school. So what's that, 40 years ago? And they're not addicted, right? But they've been using it every day. That's a Richard Pryor joke for those that are old enough. So I get it. And the guy the other day screamed and yelled at me about he says, I've been token for 55 years and I'm not addicted. And I keep thinking like, yeah, I know. I know you're not. And I mean, he just reeks of dope. And it's, you know, I'm glad he's able to get his marijuana legally now through the medical marijuana initiative that passed years ago, because otherwise he would literally have been breaking the law every day for 55 years. And so he's got a problem, in my view, this yeah. guy that I was talking to. I mean,
so does marijuana lead into other drugs?
So that's interesting. And, you know, it's like, does shoplifting lead on to murder? Because, I mean, I used to say that most murderers are shoplifters, but most shoplifters are not murderers, okay? And maybe I'm taking too many liberties when I say that. I think, you know, most people who use narcotic drugs or misuse them have used marijuana, but I don't know that most people who have used marijuana will go on to use these drugs. So, and I have lots of friends that disagree with me. They say it's absolutely a gateway drug. I won't go that far because I have not been convinced that that's true. But I will say this, the legalization of marijuana is a gateway to legalizing all these other drugs recreationally. And there's a few people in the movement to legalize marijuana who will admit that, who will tell you, I just don't think the government has any business regulating what I do with my body and what drugs I use. And then, but they're big forces behind the legalization of marijuana. Part of it's just normalizing it. I mean, people don't want to do things that are not normal. So my age, look at people my age that are, say, 60 this year. Again, we were, you know, the highest use of marijuana group. And so, but most of the people who used marijuana in 1978 stopped using it in 1979, right? So if you used marijuana a dozen times when you were in high school or college or 20 times or 50 times in college, but then haven't used it in 30 years, when you answer one of these surveys, you come across as someone who uses marijuana, even though you haven't used it in 30 or 40 years. And so when they try to present data about this, it's all about people use it. Well, over half the people have used marijuana. I mean, how can we have a law like that? Well, they stopped when they became adults.
Yeah,
you know?
They got smart.
Well, they got jobs. They got families. Yeah. And the one universal thing about any substance abuse or substance misuse that I will say that is the huge unseen tragedy is the little kids that are sitting in dirty diapers on the floor of their house while their parents are smoking dope, using meth, using heroin, drinking too much, and not taking care of them. And you know what? Those kids fill the schools. They are at very high risk later in life because of their experiences as a child with parents that are not paying attention. And so we don't talk about that, but I can tell you that it's just amazing the number of kids that are not taken care of, and it's often a result of substance misuse.
It's really sad. It's sad what's going on. And to think that we want to legalize it, compare what's happening with Colorado to Arizona.
Well, Colorado has some of the same problems that California does in the legal market. So I know a person who cultivates marijuana legally in Colorado, and he simply can't compete with the illegal production of marijuana in Colorado. So it's legal to produce it there, and they have structures and guidelines, and they have regulations and licensing and all the stuff that we're going to have, right? But as soon as you make it legal to have the substance, nobody follows any of those rules. A few people do, but then they just start producing whatever they want, wherever they want, because unless you catch them at the point of production or sale, the possession of it's legal. And so California produces more marijuana now illegally than it does legally, as evidenced by, I don't know if you saw the big shootout where 7 people were shot at an illegal grow. You know, we do a lot of backstory work on our drug cases, and there's an awful lot that comes from illegal grows in California. So I love the way, I mean, I'm reminded today of what happened at the beginning of my career. At the beginning of my career, everybody said, these mental institutions are inhumane and they cost us a lot of money. Let's try to mainstream all these people that have mental illness and we'll take them out of the institutions. We'll put them out in the community, and they'll be better off because they'll have more freedom, and they will not cost us the kind of money it does to keep them institutionalized. That was a bipartisan effort between red and blue people back when I started my career. So now, 38 years later, I have been cleaning up the mess from that every day at my job, and our communities have suffered. And worse off, these people that have been put out there living in misery, freezing their butts off underneath bridges and everywhere else, because people thought we could both save money, okay, and increase freedom, because they thought they could do that, they had this ill-conceived plan to flush these folks out into our communities and not provide them the level of service and support that they need to have. That's what's happened with mental health, in my view. Maybe I'm a little jaded, but that's certainly the case. Now what are we doing with marijuana? I mean, it's the same thing. You've got the people saying, oh, we can raise all this revenue, and we're going to send everyone to school with this revenue. And freedom, again, we hear freedom again because we want to have freedom. We don't want to regulate people's choices. And so we're doing the same thing, in my view. I mean, we're the same alliance is an unholy one sometimes. I mean, I don't like partisanship at all, but I like it less than I do. I like it more than I do nonpartisanship. I mean, it's almost like the effort for people to get together is sinister. And so we're going to save all this money, raise all this tax money. We're not. It's just not going to happen. You might get a blip for a couple of years, but this is like what happened with Indian gaming. You know, at the beginning with Indian gaming, few of the tribes made billions. They made a lot of money. And then everyone started doing it. Well, guess what? They're all struggling now. Indian gaming is struggling across the country. And I don't know. I mean, I see this as the gateway to a whole new set of social problems. What other drug have we decided, hey, tetracycline, okay, works for your acne. Let's go ahead and let people use it recreationally. Now, you can't buy penicillin. And what are you going to use that recreationally? I mean, think about it. What other drug have we said? People go alcohol. There's about a 4,000 to 10,000 year at least history behind how alcohol became alcohol. It didn't start out as a prescription drug. It didn't start out as a drug with medicinal value. It was, there's other origins to it. But okay, if that's the best you got, how's it worked for us? And do we really want to duplicate that? So, change in public policy. Do we want to become a better place, or do we want to further complicate our lives? And I think the example with how we handled mental health in the United States is the best one I can think of. I mean, it's been a tragedy for how those people have been treated. And it's we should learn from that.
Absolutely, we should learn from it. I hear people say that they think instead of law enforcement and answering certain calls, that they should send social workers to answer certain calls like a domestic disturbance. How do you feel about that?
Well, I like the sentiment. I like the thought. Okay, if we're going to do that, then let's get on the stick and get it done. Because until you do it, cops are going to have to go. So everyone likes to talk. So go out and train all your social workers and get them ready so that they're able to go out and do this. Because the only reason cops do those things is because nobody else will answer the phone. At 3 o'clock in the morning, nobody else answers the phone. And so we go out there and we fill the need for the community to try to make community safe and help these people most often. There's some tragic results, no question about it. I've been there, I've seen it. And we can do better. And it would be helpful to have more social resources, service resources. But I got to tell you, the idea of sending them to family fights are really volatile things. They're terrible. I mean, I won't say they're often called the most dangerous thing we do in law enforcement. I mean, there's other things I think we do that are probably at least at the same level. But people act like animals sometimes towards each other, especially in intimate relationships. And so I'm all for having those resources available. And if you think that that'll work, let's give it a good pilot study. Let's take place like Minnesota or Portland or someplace that likes to be out there on the bleeding edge of these issues. And let's let them go out and send people to these calls and see what happens. I just don't know. All four are using different approaches to doing this. We have used people in mental health training for many years in Tucson successfully. Even when I first started, there was something called the MAC team where we would send out social workers to go work with cops on mental health calls. So the idea that this is a blazing new idea is just, it's laughable. And so, I mean, I like the idea of having those resources available. But again, until you produce them, until they're driving around, I love the way I heard someone do an analysis the other day on one of the radio stations I was listening to, and they were saying, well, there's only like 1.3 mental health calls per day, so you need one person a day, and then they're going through it, and I'm thinking, like, you have no idea how the world works.
Okay, so there's what you're talking about.
Watch this. This shows you some understanding of how you manage a 24-hour response. There's 168 hours in a week. And you have to cover that with 40-hour-a-week people, understanding they're going to work some overtime. So it takes you a minimum of five if you jerk their schedules around, six if you want to have essentially one-person coverage most of the time. And that's what it takes to do the minimum amount of work. Now, no one's going to want to put six people out there alone, so let's make it 12 so they can work as two-person units because, well, we don't always have two cops going to a call, but you'd certainly want two social workers. So now you got 12 people. Now pay them their retirement, pay them their health insurance, pay them everything else. That's 12 people is going to cost you about $1 to $1.2 million a year. That's for a new program to do this. Well, you're going to have a supervisor for it. You're going to have to have a commander or some sort of mid-level manager that interfaces with the rest of the system. So you're probably looking at a $2 million a year program that's going to be a pilot program to try to have somebody out there that's available to assist. You got a city of over 500,000 people. Trust me, there's more than one mental health call working at any given time. So, you know, all I'm saying is it's a very complicated formula. And so put together the $2 million or $5 million or whatever you think it's going to take. Train people. Get them ready. Teach them how to run away when people are trying to kill them because they're going to have to be able to do that.
Amazing how fast you can run when somebody's shooting at you.
Yeah, and it's not often, you know, in most of these cases, I wouldn't say the firearms are the real threat. It's people that are acting out in a mental health crisis. It's
like the guy with the knife the other day.
Well, that guy was, so he did have a knife. But there's plenty of times when they don't have weapons where we are successful at dealing with these folks. In fact, it's the vast majority of the time.
Yeah.
The last time I looked, I think 12% of our calls were mental health related calls. And so, you know, but I wouldn't say that you could take all 12% of those and hand them off to social workers. I wouldn't, you know. I mean, frankly, I'm not putting them down. They've got reason for safety protocols. The fire department doesn't go to those unless we go first.
Yeah.
So, you know, if someone's having a medical problem and they're screaming and yelling in the background, the fire department sits down the street until we free up a police officer to make sure it's safe for them to go there. And so what are you going to do with social workers? You're going to do the same thing.
And they're behind the fire department.
Yeah, well, you know, they're all really well. So we had a chief here in the 60s, Bernard Garmeyer. And he went to Miami after he left Tucson. I didn't know him personally, but I knew a guy who did. And he said back in the 60s that cops were nothing but a group of gunslinging social workers. And you know what? He's dead on.
True.
He's dead on, exactly. 99% social work. And so we've already got social workers doing the job. And I'll go back to this. I think that the ubiquitous nature of video today has created a lot of this alarm, and I'm glad there is alarm. There should be alarm whenever we use force. People should be concerned. But I've watched force being used my entire career, and I can tell you it never looks good. If I had to take you, Sherry, and take you out of a car because you refused to get out of the car and you were under arrest and you decided to resist that, the battle that would ensue if it were videotaped, no matter what, would look terrible. It would look terrible.
Of course.
So the underlying issue is, in a country that has the rule of law, police officers have to use force in order, that's why we're enforcement officers, right? In order to accomplish the objectives of this government in a rule of law country. And when we use that force, it looks terrible. And so now you have the ability to see a lot more of that, and it is just absolutely alarming to people. And those few cases where things are really inappropriate, the way police officers behave, are, you know, it's magnified. But I watched a few of these cases where you watch the use of force and everyone's guffawing about how horrible it is. And it is horrible, but it's not because there's police officer misconduct, you know, in some of the cases. Many of the cases there have been officer misconduct. But I'm saying that some of them I walk away going like, how else was that supposed to end?
Yes.
So, you
absolutely.
Know.
And I don't understand why when you're told to do something, you get out of your car or put your hands against the wall or, you know, put your hands behind your back. If you're going to be combative with that situation, how do you expect law enforcement to react?
So here we are sitting sober, Okay. You and I are sitting here sober and we're talking about this, and that's not what we encounter in the field.
Exactly.
So when I say sober, I also mean mentally connected, because we have so many cases of mental illness out there, and people don't perceive things the way you and I do right here today. They certainly don't when they're smoking dope or drinking alcohol or using other kinds of drugs, and combine that with their mental illness that they may have. And they don't respond to commands, and they don't do what we ask, and we're trained to deal with that, and we are very good at dealing with that. There's the exception where it doesn't occur, and unfortunately, we have to hire people from the human race, and those folks that we hire often start with the best of intentions, and even that day they'll start with the best of intentions, and you know, particularly when you get injured. If you haven't been in a fight for your life, and many police officers have been, if you haven't been in a fight for your life, you don't know what it's like when you get injured in the middle of that fight for your life, and your lower brainstem takes over, and anyone can behave very badly under those circumstances. Now, I'm not making excuses for anyone. We have to learn to contain those impulses, right? And we do a very good job doing it. But I think the public is going to see, as they do, that what they're attributing to racist motives on police officers, I don't see that that's generally the case. What I will say is that this has opened up the conversation for racism. We're in 2 years. It's not going to be cops we're talking about so much. It's going to be banks. It's going to be real estate agents. It's going to be doctors. It's going to be healthcare, education. And it's those organizations, those institutions that have put together a world where frankly, racism has been an enormous problem, including in law enforcement, but all those other agencies, and they put these folks that we deal with in the situation that they're at. And I have to tell you, there's that definitely an economic component, there's a healthcare component, there's all these different components. Everyone has been very free to point out the things we can do in law enforcement and the training that we need and all of that. And I'm all for their participation in that. Be ready for our participation in their improvement, because we see it. We see it every day. I mean, we see people get kicked out of hospitals because the staff's just had enough of them. And they're sick, and they need to be in the hospital. So, I mean, I know where we're headed.
Sorry. That's not funny.
I know the end of my career is coming, and I see it probably today after this. No, soon enough. But I watch it, and I think it's going to happen everywhere. And this enlightenment that we see should appropriately be pointed towards the other areas that have really limited our ability to make America what it could be.
Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. We've got 2 minutes left, so what do you want our listeners to walk away with? What nugget of knowledge do you want them to know?
Well, if they haven't already voted, they need to vote for sure, because we all have a stake in this. And no matter what your belief is and who and what you want to vote for, you got to be counted. And if you haven't already decided on some of these things, I don't know what we can do for you.
Yeah.
Political ad away from knowing what we're going to do.
Me away when somebody says, I don't know what to do. And
exactly.
I'm like, you're kidding, right?
No kidding, you're the problem.
I've already got the champagne ready. I've got the dinner planned out. We're celebrating. I want a trifecta.
So I think that's what's most important. And I think you need to own that decision, and you need to own the election one way or the other. Whatever happens on the marijuana initiative, we'll follow the law. We always have. We always will. And whatever happens in the other races, you know, we're going to support the institutions that are important in America, and I think people need to do the same. So that's sort of what, you know, our perspective is and what we do. And just know that people out there are trying to do their best, and there's definitely times when we are not at the mark where we need to be. But the rest of society, you guys all need to look around and see what you can do as well.
Okay, I want to thank you for coming in. It's always a pleasure having you here. Mm-hmm. I want everybody, if you can, just say a little prayer for Scotty. I think he deserves our thoughts and prayers today. Have a very safe Halloween. Ooh. Have a safe Halloween. Until next week, we'll talk to you soon.